Rethink with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi and welcome to episode 114 of Robots. I am Jana, and in today's episode, Rodney Brooks speaks about the revolutionary new manufacturing robot named Baxter. But first, let's have a quick look at the latest news and developments with Christine.
Thank you, Jana. The Robots Association, the non-profit behind the Robots podcast you are listening to right now, has launched a first beta version of its new online platform, RoboHub. RoboHub brings together leading communicators in robotics research, startups, business and education from around the world. Content on RoboHub is broadly organized into four sections. News reports on the latest scientific and business breakthroughs through in-depth articles and news snippets. Views contributes expert opinions, editorials, and discussions. A Learn section features tutorials, micro-lectures, and other educational hands-on learning materials. And a Talk section publishes interviews with leading roboticists, including all of the Robots podcast interviews. Like the podcast, RoboHub is run by volunteers who are passionate about robotics and science communication. If you're interested in joining our team of bloggers, robotics researchers, journalists, podcast producers, or web developers, please get in touch. info@robohub.org. For more information on RoboHub and many other news and views, have a look at robohub.org.
Rethink Robotics recently unveiled a revolutionary humanoid manufacturing robot called Baxter. With coverage in the Wall Street Journal and on the BBC, Baxter has already received much media attention worldwide, and as a low-cost, multifunctional and adaptable robot, it has the potential to revolutionize manufacturing robotics for good. Our reporter Sabine spoke to Professor Rodney Brooks, one of the creators of Baxter, about the new product, its capabilities, and its potential impact on manufacturing.
Hi, Rod. Welcome to Robots.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to be here in the offices of Rethink Robotics. Congratulations on the launch of your new product.
Thank you.
Can you tell us about the vision behind Rethink Robotics?
Yeah, I've done a lot of manufacturing for iRobot in the Far East, and so I've seen a lot of Chinese factories. And I realized there were a whole bunch of problems with manufacturing in the Far East. If you're manufacturing consumer products, you have to make decisions 30 weeks ahead of when they're going to hit the shelves, and all the retailers in the U.S. want different pack-outs. So you have to decide how many of each product for each retailer, and sometimes those retailers have gone out of business before the stuff arrives. Also, I was noticing that it was getting harder and harder to get employees in China because the standard of living is going up. And this has happened many times in the history of outsourcing manufacturing from Europe and from North America since the Second World War. Originally, we outsourced to the low-cost region of Japan until their standard of living went up. Then we moved to South Korea. Then we moved to Taiwan. Then we moved to southern China. And even in the late 90s, some things, when I was building toys in southern China, were too expensive to do there already and had gone to Vietnam. So this idea of outsourcing low-cost labor didn't seem sustainable. So I started thinking, how could we make manufacturing in North America or in Europe or even in Japan more attractive? And being a roboticist, of course, the answer was robots. That's the only answer that I can come up with for any problem. But the idea was to make robots that could work in small factories for low-cost goods, because industrial robots up until now have largely been in auto factories. In the U.S., at least 70% of all industrial robots are in automobile factories. And the hundreds of thousands, it's 300,000 small manufacturers in the U.S., hardly have any robots at all because they're so hard to introduce into the factory and so expensive to introduce. So I wanted to build a low-cost robot that a small factory could have And that meant it had to be programmable by an ordinary factory worker. So it's a little like 30 years ago, we went from the mainframe to the PC. And with the mainframe computer, ordinary office workers had no access to computation, but with the PC they did. So our robot Baxter is meant to be a robot for the ordinary factory worker to interact with.
Tell us a bit more about Baxter. What does it look like? What are its sensors and actuators?
Well, Baxter, and this didn't start out this way, but Baxter ended up looking a bit like a human, with human form. It's got two arms and a head. I'll talk about the head in a minute. The two arms are slightly longer than a normal person's arms because we wanted to approximate human reach, but Baxter doesn't have any hips. As people, we bend with our hips in order to reach things. Baxter can't, so Baxter has longer arms. Looks a bit like an Olympic swimmer in that sense. It's got two arms. It's on a pedestal. The pedestal is not mobile by itself. You wheel the robot around and just lock down the wheels wherever you want Baxter to work. And the two arms have force sensing in every joint. They have 7 degrees of freedom. They have various buttons and knobs on the arms so that you can interact with the robot and tell it things. And then where there would be a head, there's an LCD screen. The LCD screen always tries to point towards you if you're near the robot, so you can see what's on it. And by default, it has a pair of eyes. Now, people say, why do you have these graphic eyes on the robot? When it's working, just as a human does, it glances where it's about to reach to. So if you're a person nearby the robot, you're never surprised by its action because it always looks where it's about to reach, so you sort of get this cue ahead of time, which helps to make it safer and predictable. But then when you're teaching the robot a new task, training the robot, the eyes move off to the corner and you get to see inside Baxter's brain and you interact through some menus with the knobs on its wrist and on its forearms and select various tasks for it to do. It has cameras in one in the LCD screen looks out at people, two in its chest that look at the workspace, and one in each wrist. So if you want to teach it about a certain object that it's going to interact with, you grab the wrist, it goes into a sort of floating mode, the arm, you bring the wrist above the object, and now you say, "This is the look at this, this is the object." Up on the screen appears what it's seeing through its hand camera. It sees its best guess of where the object is, separating it from the background, tries to do figure ground separation with no external input from the user. And you say that either say, yeah, that you've sort of got that, or no, you haven't got it. And if you tell it it's got it, then the robot starts moving the arm around from different angles, using its range sensor that's in its hand, getting multiple views of the object to build a model of it that can then recognize it for whatever task you're about to have the robot do.
Based on this description, we sort of get a sense of the flexibility of the things that we can do with this robot. Can you sort of help us understand who you think might be maybe the top three professions or the top three people who would be using this to start out with?
Well, it's really about what sort of workplaces it is. So we haven't tried to concentrate on any one particular industry. We've more had the idea that it's going to be useful for small manufacturers who don't normally have robots. To have a normal industrial robot right now, it typically takes somewhere like 8, 10, or 12 months to get the robot installed from the time you decide you want to have a robot to purchasing it, to going through the systems integration, to relaying out your factory floor so you have safety cages around the robot, etc. It takes many months, often more than a year, and the cost of the installation can be 3 to 5 times the capital cost of the robot. Our goal is 1 hour. 1 hour from when you decide you want a robot or the robot shows up to having it do useful work. And we've done that many times in tests. We've driven up to a factory that we've never been into before, and within 1 hour we've had the robot up on the factory floor doing a useful task that was already being done in the factory. And in a few minutes, we train the line workers how to train the robot. They've never seen a robot before. They don't have to understand 6-dimensional vectors or quaternions or anything like that. They just grab the robot arms, show it objects, select things from the menus, and train the task. So within that framework, small production plants, small manufacturing plants, we have a series of tasks that we're getting Baxter to do. Baxter's a physical platform, but there are going to be software releases every few months, and every few months there'll be new sorts of tasks it can do. So what it can do right now is essentially material handling, picking things up off conveyor belts or putting things on conveyor belts, putting things in arrays in single layer boxes, moving stuff around. That it's pretty good at. Then by the time we get to January, it'll also be able to press buttons on machines to do testing of objects. It knows about conveyor belts right now. It will know about some other objects early in 2013, in particular cardboard boxes. It knows a little bit about cardboard boxes right now, but during next year it will start to understand cardboard boxes to a much better degree, multiple layers where you pack things in one layer in a box, you put a separator on, you pack in the next layer. Can't do that right now with its current software, but we'll be able to do it later next year. And then machine tending is an important thing. Putting things into fixtures, taking them out of fixtures, doing tests, that sort of thing.
What other uses are there for Baxter other than manufacturing?
We have concentrated on manufacturing and our whole software system is that we're shipping to our first customers is that. But we also realize that this price for the robot with two arms, it's so much cheaper than any other platform out there that we think it's going to be great for researchers. And it's based on ROS, the robot operating system. So we're scrambling right now to get together an SDK for the robot, and we expect in the January timeframe to start shipping it to researchers all over this country at least, and with an SDK, and for people then to start doing all sorts of interesting things. Some people will work at a sort of an AI-ish level of tasks. Other people might work down at the control level with it. But I think it's going to be interesting to see when we have lots of people out there do different things with the platform. And I think they'll start to go into areas that are not manufacturing at all. One of the things I'd like to see is go into elder care. It's impossible, I think. It doesn't make sense today to go to venture capitalists and say, fund a robotics company for elder care. But I really believe we are going to need more robotics and elder care in the next 20 to 30 years because of the aging baby boomers and just not enough people to help them in their old age. So by having a low-cost platform out there, it lowers the barrier to entry to start doing experiments in that arena, for instance. So I expect to see lots of researchers do wild things with this robot that we would never have thought of.
As the general public and roboticists start reprogramming this robot, are you worried about questions of liability?
The robot is fairly inherently safe, but you know, you can, if you reprogram almost anything, you can make it do bad things, unsafe things. So there's got to be some common sense there, and we're going to have to rely on researchers having common sense.
What would you say are the main limitations right now?
Baxter is not a precise robot, and we didn't design it to be a precise robot. We designed it to be adaptable, so that if something moves in its environment, it uses its cameras to figure out where it is and go grab it. Flexible, in that it will know about many things, and therefore you can train it easily to do particular tasks. It knows most of the task already. It's just the specifics it needs. And ease of use, so that any person, anyone can train the robot to do a task. And very low-cost robot also. So they're the metrics that we evaluate whether we're successful on or not. And it has to be safe to interact with people. To be safe, we have to make it compliant. By making it compliant, it's not stiff, and then accuracy is not what you get. But a human arm is not accurate either. When we do a task, we don't precisely place a little tiny screw in an iPod by having our arm reached out, extended, 60 centimeters away from our body and try and just do it by position. We do it by sensing. We look at where the tip of the screw is, and then we actually usually brace our hand with our smaller fingers so that our thumb and an index finger can then precisely move the screw relative to the visual sighting of where the hole is. So humans don't have precision Traditional robots have had superhuman precision. Our robot is much more like a person, but it senses force in every axis. So, and that's much more like a human. So it tries to do tasks in human-like ways.
One of the limitations is that it currently has two fingers. How do you see extensions happening in the manipulation area?
Yeah, manipulation and dexterity is, I think, the great frontier for lots of robotics. Baxter actually, by default, has nothing at the end of its wrists. It's got, in the end of its wrist, it has a camera and a rangefinder, and then a mechanical plate and a connector. We're currently shipping two different sorts of hands for it. One is a two-fingered parallel jaw gripper where two fingers just slide together back and forth, and the other is a suction gripper. You can attach either of those. The two-fingered gripper, by the way, comes with a whole hand kit which has multiple sets of fingers and multiple pads that you can put on the inside or outside of the fingers, and also guards to stop how the hand moves. So there's about 100 configurations of those fingers. But we expect to bring out new versions of the hand over time, which can be installed, and we expect third parties to design their own hands. We expect larger customers to design hands in-house for particular things, but we'd love it if some little company started building dexterous hands for Baxter and sold them, and we will be publishing the interface so that, that can be done.
You spoke a lot about the importance of human-robot interactions. What did you take from your previous research at MIT to apply to Baxter?
To me, the most important thing was the idea of authenticity, that whatever the robot promises by its appearance, either just its physical appearance or the way it acts, that it's authentic in what it's promising. It delivers on those promises. You know, I've said a few times, if you build a robot that looks like Albert Einstein, it ought to be as smart as Albert Einstein or people are going to be disappointed. So we try to make Baxter be authentic in all the cues it gives. It has eyes, graphical eyes, but we don't try to make them do things that it's not delivering on. If it's glancing somewhere, that means it's going to reach there. That's a pretty simple thing to pick up on, and so people can know that if it's glancing somewhere, it's really paying attention to that thing and it's going to do something with that space. When you're training it, if it doesn't understand you, its eyes give a confused look. Well, that's because it doesn't understand you, but it's not, you know, saying it's sad, it doesn't have tears, it doesn't do things that would be inauthentic. It's surprised, its face turns red if you get really close to it, just to sort of give you the cue that maybe you're too close to the robot. But it's authentic in what it tells you. So authenticity, I think, is the big lesson I learned from our research. If it's not authentic, people are going to get very frustrated with it very quickly.
Do you have an example of an interaction with Baxter gone bad? And did you learn anything from that?
Oh, well, here's an interesting thing. You know, as engineers, we make certain assumptions about what's obvious. That may not be what the end users see as obvious. We'd spend a lot of time in factories talking to a lot of end users, but we thought we understood things, and we came up with different characteristics of different sorts of users, the tinkerer, the person who just wants to follow a script, etc. But the big surprise, the first time we took it out to a factory where the task involved an object that had to be trained, the thing that the line workers just thought was weird was, they'd show it where to pick stuff up from, they'd show it where to put stuff, but then they say, and our interface at the time had a much different feel to what it has now, they say, why do I have to show it the object? Why do I have to train the object? Can't it see the object? I just showed it the object, I moved the object around, but we had a very separate place where, now this is the object, you know, putting an object in an object library, and that just didn't make sense to the end user. To an engineer or a computer vision person or a robot scientist, well, of course you have to have the object library, that's obvious, but it wasn't obvious out to the end user. So we've tried to de-emphasize that and make it more automatic, and so that that happens without the person really having to think about that.
How difficult is the vision problem?
As a startup, we have to only choose to solve problems that are solvable. The general vision problem is not solvable. So what we do is recognize objects by a single view. So if there's an object that looks different upside down, that's two totally different objects as far as Baxter's concerned. It's just appearance-based, and it's essentially 2D. So we don't get a three-dimensional reconstruction of the object. It's views from particular angles. Now, fortunately, most things that you want to deal with in a factory will tend to have one or two or three stable positions that it's going to be on a conveyor belt. So you just sort of, if you show it how to grasp each of those, then it's learnt the objects. Now, Baxter does have specialized vision routines for special sorts of objects. So, for instance, it can see a conveyor belt in the distance just by detecting motion and model. It knows conveyor belts are this sort of continuous area of motion in the same direction, and so it knows about conveyor belts. In the first version of the software, there's nothing special about boxes, but in development, we've got software that just sort of, ding, that's a box, that's a box, that's a box. It sees boxes, because cardboard boxes are something that you can pull out and build a special detector for. And also, again, not in the first version, but face detection software in the camera above the screen. So there's certain sorts of things which people can work on, and face detection is one of those where we've got much better at over the last few years by intense work. But generic object recognition or understanding flexible material is hard. Flexible material, transparent material is another hard one for us. So there are some limitations.
With so many sensors and modeling and planning, do you feel like you were still able to stay true to your initial philosophy of behavior-based robotics?
Oh, very much. It's a behavior-based robot. In fact, when you train it to do a task, there is no representation of the sequence of the task, and that's good. Instead, there's representations of what to do. When you train it, you're essentially teaching it some behavior rules. When you see this thing over here, pick it up. But then it knows there's behaviors, like the behaviors that control the hand, know some common sense things. You can't put anything down if there's nothing in your hand. You can't pick something up if there's already something in your hand. So with those simple behaviors and simple rules, if the robot is, you know, picks something up and it's moving it to put it somewhere in a box and someone comes up and grabs the thing out of its hand, it doesn't go with its empty hand to the box and mimic putting it there. It realizes there's nothing in my hand, I can't put anything in the box. It will try and go and get something else. If it's putting something down, you know, you've said put it down on the table here, but as it's moving it down, it feels a force, it figures, well, there's something else there, I'm just going to let go of the object now. If you've told the robot to put, you know, fill a box with 4x3 widgets, 4 across and 3 deep, and there's 6 in there and it's going to put the 7th one in, but a person comes up and fills in 3 extra ones in transit, it realizes that. It doesn't try to fill the full holes. It's got all its behaviors, and it responds to the world and responds to changes in the world through those behaviors.
Baxter was 4 years in the making. Is that short? Is that long? What were some of the challenges along the way?
Yeah, the Baxter that we see today is really the 6th generation that we built during that time. The robot is low cost, and it's made in North America. So we were really looking for ways to build a low-cost robot all the while. We didn't start off, let's build the best possible robot, then figure out how to make it low-cost. We started off with low-cost as a design goal. So we did a lot of experimentation in different materials, and we use some interesting materials in order to bring the cost down and the production down. So, for instance, there are two major sorts of gearboxes in the arms, the large gearboxes and the small gearboxes. The large gearboxes are made of die-cast metal, but the small gearboxes are plastic, the outer shell, with glass impregnated. It's a very low-cost, very lightweight material, very easy to mold, and we worked on it quite a while to get it to be accurate enough that we don't need to do any post-machining for those gearboxes. So that makes it a very low-cost gearbox structure. The gears themselves, instead of being cut from metal, and we experimented with plastic gears at one point, we couldn't quite make them work well enough, but they're powdered metal. It's powdered metal, compressed, and then heat treated. Much, much cheaper than conventional gears, but not as good as conventional gears. So we have very interesting computational models of the gears that are running at full speed to counteract the imperfections in the gears so that we get by with low-cost physical stuff and computation dealing with the inadequacies of the low-cost materials to make the performance better.
So the challenge is really integration, getting the software, the hardware, getting the cost down, putting all these things together to finally get one product.
Yeah, very much integration. Even the manufacturing robot, there are sub-assemblies built in 12 different states in the U.S., and they all come together. So the last few months, because we're building this in mass production, the last few months a lot of our engineers have been working on test equipment that is now spread all across the U.S. in these various small factories that are building parts of the robot that do quality test and calibration of submodules, and those calibration numbers get stored inside submodules, and that gets pushed through the whole assembly line. So we couldn't have just built one robot at low cost. It's because we're going after mass production, but we had to do a lot of work to make mass production work, and it's complex. With two hands on, it has 18 gearboxes in the robot, seven different gear sets, and 18 gearboxes. That's a lot of mechanical stuff. It has a quad core Intel main processor, but it's got over a dozen embedded processors on connected by Ethernet within the robot. So there's a lot of computation, a lot of complexity there to make it all work.
Revolutionizing manufacturing is a very ambitious goal. When will you know that you've reached a turning point?
Well, we're at a juncture right now. We've decorated the restaurant. We've trained the wait staff. We've cooked the first meals. Now, are the customers going to like the food? We'll see. I think in 6 months we'll know whether we've got something that is plausible, because we will have had enough experience with enough customers to know plausible or not plausible. But then it'll be another couple of years, I think, before we see whether it really catches on, whether it's beyond plausible and ultra desirable.
What could be possible failure points? Is it a question of mentality of the people or the hardware or?
One of the challenges for us is that anyone who's thought about industrial robots before, their first question is, what is the accuracy and repeatability of the robot? And that's the wrong question. So to give you the counter to that, we had a little small factory in Connecticut, and owned by an individual, this factory. Actually, his father had built the factory, and now the son was running the factory. And he knew about industrial robots. He'd never had one before, and we brought the robot there. We showed it how to do a task, got his workers to show it how to do a task. It was doing the task, and he came over. And then one of our engineers came and just pushed the robot 10 centimeters to the side. And he was, oh, no, now we've got to go through it again. But the robot just kept working because it was using vision. So we moved the base 10 centimeters. It didn't affect the robot operating. So that shows you how precision and repeatability is the wrong question. But nevertheless, that's the question everyone asks, and they want to compare it to other industrial robots, and it's not a good comparison. I try to explain, for instance, that Honda, with their new Asimo robot, their newest one, they're very proud of it because it can actually jump on one foot, and it can jump a few millimeters. And I say to people, would you ask, you know, one of the big industrial robot manufacturers how high their robot can jump? No, you wouldn't. It's the wrong question. It's the right question for the Honda Asimo. It's not the right question for traditional industrial robots. And the questions for traditional industrial robots are not the right questions for us. But that's a real dangerous place for us, because people will continue to ask that question. And we have to figure out how to let them see that it's no longer a relevant question. Not a relevant question for our robot. The relevant question for our robot is, how easy is it to train? How adaptable is it to changes in the environment? Which, by the way, a traditional industrial robot scores terribly on, but that's not questions that are normally asked about then.
You're clearly one of the best-known roboticists, and you've been very successful in business between iRobot and Rethink Robotics. What are your tips for young entrepreneurs who want to start their own business?
Well, you know, I've been very successful. Well, I was very successful with iRobot, and now WeThink is on the verge of either, you know, we're about to find out. But I've also had three failed companies. And, you know, what I didn't understand early on was you have to build something that people want to buy. And I think often a researcher is so in love with their particular research technique, and they're so used to selling it to funding agencies. Here's this great technique, fund me to do more of it. They think, oh, if I start a company with this technique, it's the technique I'm going to sell. You can't sell a technique. You have to sell something that provides value to the customer so they want to buy it. And that's, I think, the hardest lesson for researchers to get.
Would you advise them to go for a low-hanging fruit or a transformative goal like you're doing now?
It depends on your personality. I mean, you know, if we see the same thing in web companies. Some of them have gone for low-hanging fruit and done very well, and then there's been transformative ones like Facebook or Google. You're not going to produce an enormous company unless you try something transformative, but the risk goes way, way up. So it depends on your appetite for risk and your willingness to deal with failure, because most transformative ideas fail.
How's the funding landscape right now for robotics?
Robotics is doing well right now, especially in the Boston area. We've had a big success with iRobot, and then the Kiva system, which has its Swiss connections, was sold to Amazon for a large price. So that's got people realizing that robot companies can do real things. And there's a lot of robot companies in the Boston area. So the Boston venture capitalists are sort of taking it as a point of pride. We're going to keep pushing robotics here.
Last question. What's next for WeThink Robotics?
Well, WeThink Robotics has to produce in scale. We have to be producing thousands and thousands of robots and selling thousands and thousands of robots in order to be the sort of success we want. We need to listen carefully to our customers, adapt the robot if we see that it needs changes, and then think about other parts of manufacturing that Baxter can't do and see if we can come out with some follow-on products that will work in those areas.
Do you already have any projections on sales 10 days after the launch? Or?
We have no projections on sales, and the example that I use for that is the Roomba. At iRobot, when we were first, we announced it in September 18th, 2002, exactly 10 years before WeThink's robot. The board thought there was no way we could sell 15,000 robots before Christmas. Well, we sold 70,000. So making predictions was we would have been totally off base with the predictions we had. I can't tell you how many Baxter robots we're going to sell at this point. We really need, I think, a good year or so in the field to get a feel for how well it's accepted and how useful people find it before we could come up with any sort of accurate models.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Rod, for being here with us on Robots.
Well, thanks for having me again.
And that's the end of today's episode. As always, you can find more information, images, and videos linked to all our episodes on our website at robotspodcast.com. We will be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. WeThink with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.